Hello, and for today's episode, we're going to talk a little bit about women's land trust and women-oriented intentional communities. So why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself and about how.
Okay, hi, I'm Lonnie Raven, and I've been involved with various forms of women's community for quite a long time, and also just community. That can just be condos, that can be kibbutz, you know, there's a lot of different things I've run into over the years. So the last, I don't know, about 10 years, I've been involved with HOW, which is Huntington Open Women's Land. It is one of the few existing, surviving women's land trusts in the United States. So each one of them, I think, is a little bit different in the way HOW is organized. We own the land outright, which was in itself quite a donation and quite a process. And we're a nonprofit, and we have a collective which functions today as a board. It used to be more hippy dippy, and we manage Howl, and we have right now we have one resident. We've had up to six residents over the different times over the years. We have a farmhouse, and a barn, and 50 acres of land.
Nice. So. I hear people talking even today about forming a trust and women's only land, like a safe space. So what year did it get started, and wasn't that pretty common back then, and trying to make that empowerment of women buying their own land?
So, I wasn't there directly, but this is my understanding. So I apologize if I'm saying something that's not totally accurate. I'm basing what I know on my friends who were there or who were around that time. I'm also basing what I'm saying a lot on Crow Cohen's recollections and her book. She was a good friend of mine. She passed away 6 years ago. And she was not one of the founding mothers, but she was very involved before and after the actual purchase process. So this was the early 80s, and Burlington, Vermont already had a very, very active and radical lesbian feminist community. And the idea was to create a place where you could get away from the patriarchy. And by you, I mean all women. And the idea was to be as encompassing as possible. It wasn't just lesbians, and it wasn't just women of any particular flavor. It was like all women. Anybody can benefit from this. In de facto, it was all lesbians from the community, but that was their vision to begin with. So it's always been a little bit different than lesbian land, because it was never defined as lesbian only land, but it was for women. So you could learn how to do things, be empowered, experience one place on earth without the patriarchy. That was the vision.
Nice.
And at the time, they were looking for someplace rural, out of the way. And now we have someplace that's rural and out of the way, which is a problem, because then it's hard for women to come to it, visit.
Now, so the trust was like gathering people who would donate, and then they had enough money to buy land and put it in trust. Is that how that part worked?
So there was one woman who actually had money, and she purchased 200 acres. And of that 200 acres, she sold 50 to Huntington Open Women's Land, which was a registered nonprofit, and whose mission included to be a land trust, as well as a place for women. So she sold it at a discount, for lower than the actual price. She also either sold or gave land, not quite clear, to another organization called Konsekea. She gave 100 acres to them. And I think, I don't know exactly how that worked, but there was some there was some agreement that was very long term, and there might have been an exchange of money recently. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't want to misinform anyone. But she was a very generous person, and she enabled a nonprofit without a lot of money to purchase outright the land.
Very nice.
So we don't have a mortgage or anything.
Wonderful. And so, yeah, because that's the way people are always trying to figure out, how do we form a community? So that's one way, if you find a generous person and can put it in trust. So the people who live there, the women who live there, they don't own the land, but they're part of the community and then learn farming skills and, I guess, maintenance of the farmhouse.
Well, Howell has been around for about 35 years. So it varies according to the actual women who were there.
Mm-hmm.
So what we try and have, that anybody who lives on the land is a resident caretaker. So she's a resident and she's a caretaker. So she does both. She also pays some money so that we can get wood to heat the place, so that we can pay the property tax. So it's sort of like rent, but it's a little bit different. And it's a month-to-month thing. So if she decides, you know, I am going someplace better, then she can leave. Nobody's there. We want it to be a partnership. So each person brings herself, and whatever she likes to do, she gets to do. There's some minimum things that have to get done, and either she does them or she doesn't, you know. For a long time, we had people there who, it functioned as really affordable housing, because we don't take a lot of money. So compared to other places in Vermont, we take very, very low cost, because we're just covering our costs. We're a nonprofit. Nobody's making money off of this. The caretaking is plowing, snow plowing, cutting the grass, taking care of the grounds. It's also welcoming women that come and visit. So there's a wide variety of things that need to get done. And some women do it better. Some women have more time. Some women have less time. Some women, you know, want to work on the land, but can't. It's not really their forte to show other women around. You know, it depends on the person.
Okay. And so if someone wants to visit, is it the same process as wanting to stay, since it is month to month, or at least they both start at the same place?
So over the years, we've gotten pretty well organized in order to keep community safe and happy.
Mm-hmm.
And, we our goal is a good community, a mm-hmm. good, tolerant, respectful, loving community.
Aww.
So we found, and this collective has been really pretty unified for the last 10 years. So it's been a little different in years past, but I can tell you what we've worked out. Number one, we try and be as welcoming as possible to as large a group of people as possible. So over the years, we've, it was originally all women. All women are welcome. Doesn't matter any other attribute, color, orientation, whatever, you know, all women are welcome. And then about 10, 15 years ago, the question of trans women came up. And we went through a process and we finally said, trans women are welcome. Trans, you know, anybody who defines themselves as a woman is welcome. And much more recently, like within the last year, we have decided that all women, self-defined, non-binary, transgender, are welcome at home.
Great.
So again, we're trying to, be really broad-minded and welcoming to anyone that would want to come to Howell, and those seem to be the groups that want to come to Howell, and those also seem to be the people that would like to create an alternative to the patriarchy.
Very nice. Now, what about children? Have they been allowed, or?
Yes. In general, we say babies and children are allowed up to age 10. After age 10, girls.
Oh, okay. All right.
Very so, but, nice. But the thing is, that also is to the extent that it's feasible. Like we have, if we have a resident who has a kid who happens to be a male, you know, an adult, I'm saying not to live, but to visit, then they visit. You know, we've worked out that if there's a guy that needs to come to Howl, it works, you know? It's not like you can't come to Howl. So what we've done is we just say, well, if a guy needs to come to Howl for some reason, he's either related or friends with one of the residents or there's some other reason, we say, okay, so number one, not to have that happen when we're having an activity. You know, that's a women's activity, women and non-binary. And also let everyone who's on the land know, and if there are no objections, then it's fine. So I had circumstances where my brother needed to come up, so he came up one night. Residents, like I said, have male relatives, and they come up too.
Yeah.
And they visit, and they can stay, you know, just like your house. You know? So, you know, we have a warden that needs to come up, and it's a guy, so.
There you go. So you said that you've been a very, you've become a great group in the last 10 years. Is there something people can copy to make their groups similar, that everything is gelling?
We work hard, and we do challenge each other. You know, it's like a family at this point. I think the main thing is that we're all pretty dedicated to Howl. And we all have different things that we think are the best for Howl. So we talk it out, and we're willing to compromise, and we're willing to talk as much as we can respectfully to each other, and not, you know, say, I'm leaving, you know, not walk away. I mean, people do, that's happened, and then they're not part of the collective. There's not much I can do about that. But the women that are now in the collective are pretty dedicated and have the maturity not to just walk away when things get tough.
So it's a core group that wants to continue with the mission through thick and thin. Very nice, very nice. Now, you also know a lot about kibbutz. So tell us a little bit about how you learned about that and how that influenced your involvement with Howl or in communities.
Well, I've always been interested in community. You know, I lived in Israel for 17 years, and I only lived on a kibbutz for, I want to say, six weeks, 2 months, something like that, and that was under extreme circumstances. There was a war.
Oh, okay.
And I was in, how shall we say, Area A. Or Area Zero. So I wanted to leave where I was very quickly, and I ended up going to a friend's kibbutz.
Okay.
So I lived there for 6 weeks. But other than that, you know, if you grow up, if you live in Israel, you get to learn a lot about a kibbutz, about the history and the ongoing development, because it's all changing at this point. How it was 60 years ago or 90 years ago is very different than the way it is today, and it's evolved and sort of morphed into something much more capitalist because that's what people wanted. So today, there's very few traditional kibbutzes where everyone really shares all the resources. Most people earn their own money either on the kibbutz or off the kibbutz and have their own budget and can have 100% choice about what they do with the money that they earn. But when I lived on the kibbutz, this was January, February 1991, so this was a while ago.
Okay.
It was the kibbutz that I was on was a pure kibbutz. So For example, nobody was allowed to own a car. There were a few communal cars. So because there was a war going on and I was living there, I had to get to work in the morning. So I didn't have a car and I couldn't take a car from the kibbutz because I'm not a member. So I would hitch a ride every morning. And the people who would pick me up, it was one Bedouin guy because there was a Bedouin village right next door and it's a privatized village. So he had a car that he would take women to the local factory and he would pick me up.
Aww.
So, you know, there was a whole story there too.
Wow. Well, so it sounds like this was the first Iraq war and Israel was caught in the crossfires from what I remember here.
You remember correctly.
Okay, January, February. Well, a lot of people, and actually I got to stay, I think, just 2.5 weeks on a kibbutz. And I know at that time, usually you had to, you know, sign your life away for at least a year. So anything less than a year is kind of like, whoa, how did you get to do that? So now I know how you got to do it. Mine was part of a study program where we studied the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But one thing I loved was how they got together on Saturday night and had Shabbat dinner. And there was a pool and everyone had their individual houses at that time, but they did have a few businesses. And so that's what I, co-housing is similar to what I saw then, which was a mix between the complete socialism where you drop your kids off and see them once a day when kibbutz first started. And I guess now is even more privatized, but that it seemed to have that community feel where you share some things, but you also have your private lodging. So now I know a lot of co-housing are similar to the kibbutz in that way. But you also said a lot of communes like Twin Oaks was actually based on the kibbutz model.
On the classic, the old kibbutz model.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when I was a kid, I lived in Israel for a year. I was staying with my aunt, and she had friends on the kibbutz, so I would visit the kibbutz with her. And so I got to get to know the kids. I would hang out with the kids. And I can tell you, the idea of the children's house scared the hell out of me.
Was it the ruthlessness, like children in charge, or the no parents?
Yeah, children are in charge, yes. Yes.
Got it.
Scary.
See, having teenagers, I like that idea of them on their own in their own house.
Yeah, well, think Lord of the Flies.
Yes, yeah, no, yes, and exactly. So I guess there's a mix. I don't know if they're still doing that part, but yes, there's definitely a lot of information. I like how you say that a lot of what people are doing in the United States with intentional communities, they could look at kibbutz. Now, is there books or resources people can look to find, like what's happened or experiences they can learn from kibbutzim?
So the answer is yes. And how much is in English? I have no idea.
Oh, well, that's a problem then. Yeah.
So there's a good book by Bruno Bettelheim called Children of the Dream.
Children of the Dream. Okay.
And that was, that's an old book. It's from the 60s. Where he or other people did research about the kids growing up on kibbutz. So they were growing up in the children's houses. And I've read that book, and I'd say it's fair. You know, it's not growing up the way kids normally grow up. And that's why those children that later became adults said, our kids go to the children's house? No.
Oh.
And so when those kids grew up and had kids of their own, that's when the children's houses got dismantled.
Okay.
So that's one thing. So Children of the Dream, I mean, you know, basically from what I remember, I mean, I read this when I was a teenager myself. He was saying that when you grow up where the peer pressure is really the driving aspect of your existence, then you become very adept at living with a group, but you also have to tamp down your own individuality and you become very guarded. And that leaks into your life. You know, you can't grow up that way and not have it affect your life.
Wow.
So they became really good soldiers. They got along in the army really well. But, you know, then it's a certain background that you have to overcome. And that those newly minted adults themselves didn't want their own children going through that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was all an experiment. It really was. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they're like, yeah, that part wasn't so good. I like that idea. And I know there have been some, crossover with Foundation of Intentional Communities and Kibbutzim. So a lot of people have noticed similarities.
I want to say one more thing about that, though, just so that you don't just get the idea that it was a terrible idea and we're not doing it anymore. The kibbutz turned out to be an interesting experience for women. Because on the one hand, they were shunted into the child rearing and the sort of the houseworky kind of jobs, the laundry, the kitchen, the child, the children's houses, that kind of thing. So they were definitely shunted there. On the other hand, in the classic kibbutz, there was no financial pressure. So you were free of capitalism, really. You had a place to live, food to eat. You had a roof over your head. You had free medical care. You didn't have to worry about making a living. You worked. I mean, everybody worked really hard because there's a lot of peer pressure to pull your weight. So if you want to get along in a kibbutz, you have to work. You have to show that you're working. But everybody, men and women, have to do that. And women over the years, said, hey, I don't want to just do childcare. I want to do other things. So, there's that friction and the same kind of feminist issues come up in the kibbutz. But you didn't have financial, economic hardship. So what happened was women ended up having more kids. So the kibbutz birth rate is actually higher than in the cities. Because you could afford to actually have as many kids as you wanted.
Wow.
And there was a lot of communal childcare, so it was also easy to have a kid. You weren't, enslaved to your children.
Wow.
So it's different. I mean, mm-hmm. there are good points and bad points to that. But the point is, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
And there were good points that, can you only take the good points from every single, experiment or every single social situation? I don't know.
Right.
There's
right.
good and bad for everything. But that's very different than city life for women.
Yes. And that shows a lot of when you take away certain pressures. Oh, look, all these children. And even that idea that a lot of intentional communities want also, which is you will be taken care of. You don't have to worry about the ones who work together financially. You don't have to worry about an outside job. You don't have to worry about your health care. We will take care of each other. That's wonderful. And I think kibbutzim have changed, but everything changes. I mean, the first one was what, 1909? So a lot has changed. But just that certain parts, the kids were like, yeah, we're not doing the kid house anymore. we're gonna do this instead and adapt it. And I know that some, you can go and there's a hotel. So, there's all sorts of different things.
Well, there's really interesting kibbutzim in Israel now. There's a kibbutz that was organized on the principle of, at the time, at least, transcendental meditation. I have a friend today who was in a kibbutz that's organized around Waldorf education.
Nice.
The kibbutz, there's people that are religious, there are people that are not religious. There's a lot of different, it's a good way to organize, to do experiments and to organize.
Yeah.
So the Waldorf kibbutz, their industry was education, was a school. So, and that, and that's still there today.
Wow. Well, I could see that. And I've seen interest in intentional communities here in the U.S. with the same idea where a school is at the center. And there have been, I know in the past, some communes centered like that. So that's really nice. Now, one thing I forgot to ask about Howell, is there Wi-Fi?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So there is Wi-Fi. So a woman who can work on the, you know, work from home, then they don't have to worry about the job part.
Correct. Yes.
So that's,
yeah, most women that come to Howell, they do need a day job of some sort because we're asking for money. We are part of the capitalist situation. You know, we have to pay property tax, which is quite a lot, you know. And we have to pay for heating and, you know, we have to upkeep. And then we have to have, we have capital expenses. We have a house that's falling down. We have a barn that, that almost is falling down.
Oh, no.
We just re-roofed our barn, which is money. So if you like the idea of women's land, we also, you know, we need the women's community to also donate. And they do.
Okay.
We get donations.
Great. Now, are you in touch with other women's land or lesbian land? Because you did mention there was a difference. I guess the difference being it wasn't meant just for lesbian women. It was meant for women. Was that the difference you meant versus other?
That's one difference. Over the years, everybody has to deal with, you know, new things that develop in society. So the thing with trans and non-binary, there's a thing with aging, you know, the women, a lot of the women's lands are lands that are primarily like houses dotting the landscape where, you know, a woman lives here, a woman lives here, a woman lives here. We don't function like that. We're a nonprofit. We can have activities, we can have programming. We have camping weekends. We do hip camp, so we have campsites. But we're not, and we can have a collective of people that don't necessarily live at Howell. So we have a format that's a little more flexible than other women's lands, where the only people who are involved are the people that live there.
I see.
And then they age, and then the question is, okay, what happens? You know, or there's. And there's another, I think there's some land in New York State where one woman owns the land and she can do what she wants, like she's the boss. So whatever format she wants can happen. I mean, and that's, in some ways it's easier than how, because we work more or less on consensus, which is hard. And
no.
Slow.
But then the people living on that land, they also, well, if she doesn't want me here, or, you know, when she, who knows what happens when they pass on. So there's
right.
Give and take to every every
right.
Situation.
And I know that in other women's lands across the United States, they, you know, the women there are getting on in years. So they've either turned into retirement communities, or they've dissolved in some way. I mean, you know, we're also hanging on by the skin of our teeth. But we have a little bit of flexibility because we're a nonprofit, and a woman who's interested in how can be very active and do a lot without living there.
Very nice. Now,
I've never lived there.
So tell us how anyone can, you know, donate $1 million as they're listening to this and trying to figure out where to put it. And or just get information about visiting or staying there from month to month. Where do they go to find this information?
So we have the internet, and where we have a website, www.howlvt.org.
So for Vermont, so howl.vt.org.
No, howlvt.
Oh, no dot. Okay, no dot,
no dot
for Vermont. Okay, no
dot. .org.
Okay, howlvermont.org. Yeah,
that's,
very
that's
nice.
That's a website. We have a Facebook page. And on the website, you can donate. We have a donate button. We're kicking and screaming, but we've moved into the 21st century.
very nice.
Take PayPal. We're working on Venmo. anything checks.
Very good. Very good.
We have an address. You can mail checks. You know, we're all volunteers, so most of the checks get cashed on time. Not all the time. I try. And that's me. That's my fault. I'm the treasurer. The buck stops with me. And then I mentioned the Facebook page. And the other thing is you, too, can experience your own little patch of Howl every summer. You can camp at Howl. We have an amazing, amazing camping because we have 50 acres. Half of it is just meadow. Oh. So we've plowed. We've cut the grass in certain areas. So you have these beautiful remote campsites that you're kind of all on your own. You're all alone. Nice. You, it's just you, the mountains, and the sunset. So we do that. We organize the camping through a website called hipcamp.com. And if you go to www.hipcamp.com/Howl Meadow, you too can camp at Howl.
Nice.
Now I wouldn't recommend it. There's snow there.
Well, for some that might be nice. Now, and that would be women and children under a certain age only for the camping.
Well, that would be okay. So actually, our biggest issue is actually dogs.
is what?
Dogs, not the humans.
Really? What do dogs do when they camp?
Well, they can eat the chickens, which is bad. They can chase the cats, which is bad. So, you know, we like polite dogs that are with polite, responsible owners.
There you go, dogs. So dogs have a certain, there's rules about the dogs. Okay.
There's rules about the dogs, yeah. Right. And, you know, we invite to camp at Howl the same slice of humanity that we welcome at Howl. So that's women, self-defined, non-binary, transgender. So if you and a bunch of your gay male friends want to camp, Howl is not the place.
Okay. Now, since you've been involved with Howl, have you seen how people feel when they're in that non-patriarchal world, even if it's just a weekend? What do you notice with the women who go there and how they feel?
Generally, they love it. I've heard very few, if any, negative experiences. Like, we explain what it is. So if you're expecting, you know, something else, you're not going to get it. But if we explain what it is and what it's not, then they come with the correct expectations. That's number one. Number two, we work, you know, there have been no indoor activities, you know, for a couple of years because of COVID. When we did have indoor activities, we still field a lot of questions about who's allowed to come at Howl, is it safe for me, and that kind of thing.
Mm.
So we've worked very hard, and I know that's been it's been a big thing that I've been very focused on, is creating actual, real, safe space and respectful space at Howl. So that means being polite to other people, even if you've never met somebody like that before. And you can talk about whatever you want. We don't censor or tell people to leave because of their opinions. But we reserve the right to tell them to leave if they're not behaving respectfully to other people. So that's a really important thing that I'm glad you're giving me an opportunity to talk about it. That's different than everywhere on planet Earth.
Exactly.
Because that enables people to live and for a short amount of time, not forever, but at least meet on common ground. And if you're respectful, you can have whatever opinions you want. And you also get a chance to get to know people that you may have some pre or misconceptions about. So the example that I don't know if it's politically correct to tell you this. I've been shushed a little bit sometimes, but I will say it. We had one of our residents was friends with someone who was connected to Alex Dobkin, you know, before she died, obviously.
Yeah, recently. And,
yeah, so Alex Dobkin came to Howl to perform. She did a house concert.
Nice.
And we sold out in 24 hours. It's ridiculous. Like, that's never happened to us. Never before or after.
That
never.
Is so funny.
Like, we were hoping the floor would hold all those people.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that.
It went fine, yeah. And the thing is, you know, when we wanted to, and afterwards, Alex, she was going to sleep over, and she wanted to have, like, a discussion activity afterwards. So we said, sure. And all over our website, if you go to our website, we're very clear. We are open to anyone who identifies as a woman, self-defined, and non-binary, you know, whatever. So, and gender expansive persons. So when we tried to advertise through the local Pride Center, they said, we can't advertise because she said things that are anti-trans.
Oh, in the past. Okay.
Yes.
Mm.
And I said, we do not discriminate on the basis of opinion. She is coming to Howl. She can easily see what our policies are. If she's decided that she's coming to Howl, she's playing by our rules. So she came to Howl, and she played by our rules. Like, I don't care what she thinks and what she says when she's not at Howl. At Howl, she was respectful. We had a discussion, and she did bring up... She didn't bring up the term transgender women.
Mm-hmm.
She just said men.
Mm.
And we spoke about this respectfully. You know, we had a very good conversation. There were actually transgender people in the room, you know, and it all went really well. And afterwards she said, you know, to me, she said, well, I, you know, we probably don't agree on everything, but it was really good having this discussion. And we hugged.
Aw, very nice. I think that's a wonderful story. And maybe, like you said, there's no place on earth like that. But we need to be like that. Because, you know, lots of people, like I just found out who got canceled this year. And I was like, I missed that controversy. So instead of, you know, oh, we're never going to talk to you again, find a space where you respectfully, talk to each other in a certain behavior, yeah, that's not allowed. And maybe they right. will be open to at least hearing why it was so hurtful to other people.
Well, we, you know, when, and we get a lot of older women who tell us, who are not happy about our welcoming this wide diversity of people. And my answer to them is, we have had many, many activities where we're welcome all kinds of people, and they're all respectful and wonderful. And you feel the safety, and that makes people feel good. So we invite people, we tell people, if you behave respectfully, you will get respect, and you will feel safe that way. And I've talked to women who say, how can you, you know, create safe space. You're ruining Howl. Like, I've been told that many times in many different tones of voice. And my answer is, you should come to Howl to an activity and see how it works, because in actuality, it's a beautiful, beautiful experience. It's really wonderful, because people, when they feel accepted and respected, they give that out 10 times over. And that's what everyone, that's like a real need that everyone is, that's what people are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what people are looking for.
Wow. Well, I know my summer plans now. I'm going to have to look at how to camp at Howl, how to visit. And yes, I think that's wonderful to focus on behaviors and respect. And then there's so we can have an amazing community. Well, thank you so much. Is there anything I missed that you would like to share? And I'm always welcome to have people back, so don't feel
well, this is the end. I would just say also that vision that we're striving for, it also means that there are plenty of people that it doesn't work for them to really stay at Howl long term, because they don't have the maturity or the social skills or internal resources to really do that. And so, you know, it's like, I don't want to use the word, but it kind of comes to mind, where we say, we have rules, we're strict, you know, we cannot welcome women to Howl that can't really, that don't have good boundaries, for example. We just can't. We're not strong enough to work around those women, those people. So if somebody is not going to respect those rules, we have to respectfully ask them to leave. And that's, you know, that's being a little stricter than Howl was in 1983.
But if it's, you know, that's what I always think. If you focus on behavior and you're still respectful for the person, to say, you know, Howl is not for you at this moment, and this is the rules. These are the strict rules. And you said that some people, Howl wasn't for them, but they're amazing people and have done great things outside. And
oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to live in community. It's hard to live in Howl. It's rural. We haven't quite gotten a washing machine up there, where that's another one of our goals. But you got to go 10 or 15 or 20 miles to do laundry. You know, it's tough. So it is not for everyone. It's not for the, you
know. For many reasons. And yeah. Your dog has to be polite. So
dog that definitely. Too.
Definitely polite dog. Children may be rude, but dog's polite, huh?
Well, the I mean, children personally
learning.
I have a lot of leeway for kids, but you know, I'm not the only one that makes the rules around here.
Right. Well, and living together. Well, thank you so much. And like I said, we can come on again. Maybe we'll get some questions and more people interested. But I think this is a amazing conversation and a lot of history, her story there, and great way to model a community.
Thank you. You might want to talk to our resident. So, and she has other experiences, you know, outside of Howl. She's a very interesting person.
Okay. So that would be great.
I can connect you.
Great. Well, thank you. I'm going to end the show there, but you and I will still talk. And thank you again. And I know we're posting this at the end of the year, so it's that time of tax time. So remember, all that extra millions, make sure to donate to Howl, or at least a washing machine. All right. Thank you.